I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Mark Pinsky is a former staff writer for the Los Angeles Times and the Orlando Sentinel. His new book, Meta on the Mountain, chronicles 20 years of investigative reporting in a quest to solve the murder of federal anti-poverty worker Nancy Dean Morgan in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina. I'll talk to him about her story and how he went about writing his first true crime book. Also, the University of Central Florida's football team is having one of their best seasons in the history of the college, ranking number 23 in the latest BCS standings. As the team prepares to face off against Houston in this weekend's homecoming game, I'll talk with the UCF Knights head coach, George O'Leary. That's ahead on Intersection. Mark Pinsky is a journalist and author. He was the Orlando Sentinel's religion reporter, and before that he spent many years covering the crime beat for the LA Times. He has a new book out. It's called Meta on the Mountain. It chronicles his quest to solve a murder case that dates back more than 40 years to June 1970, when the body of a young federal anti-poverty worker, Nancy Morgan, was discovered in the backseat of her government-issue Plymouth in the woods of Madison County, North Carolina. Well, Mark Pinsky has been interviewed on Intersection before about his book, Amazing Gifts. Mark, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back.
You first came across this story as a columnist for the Duke University Chronicle, and I guess that was at the start of your career as a journalist. What made you pay attention to the story?
Well, I was politically active in the late 1960s on the campus of Duke University. I wrote a column for the campus daily called The Readable Radical, and I marched and demonstrated and made speeches on the Quad and was fully involved in the politics of the late 1960s. And so when I was in the Chronicle office and opened the newspaper and saw that this woman's body had been discovered up in the mountains, I felt an instant kinship to her. Political, generational, her picture looked like a lot of my friends. She was in the organization called Vista, and I had a friend who was in Vista. She was a military brat, raised from a military family, and my girlfriend at the time was also that. So there was just a spectrum of identification with her.
Mm-hmm. And just for the benefit of our listeners, VISTA stands for Volunteers in Service to America. Would you explain just briefly what Nancy Morgan was doing in Madison County in 1970 as part of this program?
VISTA in those years was described as the domestic Peace Corps. So people went into impoverished communities, urban communities, Indian reservations, and migrant worker camps, and also included were some communities in the southern Appalachian Mountains where poverty is endemic and has been for centuries. And what Nancy Morgan did was very grassroots kind of thing. She would do recreational stuff for kids. The other members of her group that were there would take people to doctor's appointments. They would try to organize medical clinics because they're often not a doctor in any close proximity. Nancy started a secondhand clothing store for people so people could buy decent clothes at a fraction of their cost. Just basically to go into a community, assess what they thought they needed, and then with local people in the lead where possible, facilitated those different small ameliorative efforts to make their lives better. On the side of the people who came in, there was a great degree of naivete when they came in about what they could do. They were coming with what I call the altruistic impulse to do good. On the other side, the people of Madison County and the Southern Mountains in particular, they've seen these people come and go for 200 years. Missionaries, first religious and then secular, beginning in 1800, the Methodist circuit rider Asbury came into the town where the murder took place in 1800 and complained. I say in the book, he came into town with on horseback with Christian temperance in one saddlebag and disdain for fiddle music in the other, the two worst things he could have been equipped with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over the years, first the Methodists were in this county. In the 1880s, the Northern Presbyterians came, and they built missions and churches and boarding schools and medical clinics and craft cooperatives, and they did some great work. But then ultimately they gave up and they left, and the culture returned to what it was. So the same issues that the Vistas faced in the 1960s had been addressed over time: alcoholism, violence, nutrition issues, literacy issues. So the people in this local area and the Southern Mountains generally were just, they were used to do-gooders coming and going, and so they were a little bit cynical about them. They all came with the best intentions, but sometimes their efforts turned out to be ill-fated.
So what happened to Nancy?
I believe while she was there, she made a good connection. I think the people in Madison County, in her area of Madison County, in Shelton Laurel was the area that's called, they liked her. She was a sweet person. She was dedicated. She had sincere idealism. But in the end, I think she was just at the wrong place at the wrong time, and something terrible befell her.
The murder, too, brought a lot of unwelcome attention to the area, and you write, too, about some of the, you know, the opinions of the folks who live in Shelton Laurel and Madison County. They were almost suggesting that she'd somehow brought it on herself, or the fact that there were these vistas in that area had kind of attracted trouble to the county, and they weren't too happy about that either.
Right. They were young. They were college-educated. They were middle-class in background. They drank. They smoked. They used bad language. It's odd. They were very careful about not using drugs. If they had used drugs on the campus, which probably some of them did, they were very careful not to use drugs while they were there. People in the area kind of projected on them a sort of free love, sexual promiscuity, but they took great care not to engage in relationships, either with local people or with each other, just for that reason. It didn't, in the end, people still suspected them of bringing drugs into Madison County and to living this free life, which was not, in fact, the case, at least based on my research. But there was this, times were changing. The culture was changing in America generally in the late 60s, and it was slower to come to Madison County because of its isolation. So people were threatened. I mean, the men in the Vista group had hair a little bit longer than before, not shoulder length, not, you know, big hair, but it was just long enough to make them thought of as long hairs. Mm-hmm. And all of what the people in Madison County were seeing on television, those that had television, and hearing on radio about the great cultural changes they projected on these Vista people who were, for the most part, squeaky clean intentionally.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm talking to Mark Pinsky. He's a journalist and author. He was the Orlando Sentinel's religion reporter. We're talking about his new book. It's called Messer on the Mountain. It's about his quest to solve the murder of Nancy Morgan, whose body was found in the backseat of a government-issue Plymouth in the woods of Madison County back in June 1970. You can join the conversation online on Facebook, on Twitter. You can also send us an email, wmfe.org. Mark, what's been your experience of going back to talk to people in Madison County over the years? Because you really have been following this case. As you say, it was a long-term project for you, and you've finally kind of brought it to fruition. But have things changed in the way people's attitudes towards the case have developed over those 40-some years?
Yes, I was interested in the case from the time it happened, but I actively researched it and reported it for close to 20 years. Now, my first reporting trip was in 1994. And in the beginning, there was extreme skepticism and reluctance on the part of local people to speak with me. Here I was, a Jew from the Jersey suburbs, living in Florida, which a lot of Florida people have moved up to Western North Carolina. It's like I was their worst nightmare. And there was some skepticism when I first got up there. But I went up year after year, usually a week in the spring, a week in the autumn. And I had a list of people I wanted to speak with. And some people wouldn't speak to me. Some, those who did speak to me, I think were not entirely honest, which as a journalist, I'm used to. But over time, I think if they didn't come to trust me, they got used to me. I wrote a few pieces, one for the Sentinel, a travel piece not involving the murder, that showed the kind of work I did. It showed a kind of affection for Madison County and its people. And so people began opening up to me as well. Also, mm-hmm. in the beginning, there was this great reluctance because this murder was a great blot on this county. And some people said, why are you dredging up this old murder? It can't help us. It can't help our image. It took us 100 years to get over an infamous Civil War massacre that took place in Madison County. They got the name, Bloody Madison for this massacre during the Civil War. And now this other horrible thing that happened to us, or happened here, some felt because of what the Vista people brought on themselves. Why are you dredging it up? But ultimately, most of the people I wanted to speak with spoke with me. Unfortunately, some people I didn't get to in time, and they either passed away or dementia set in, and because it was a long time. It was an old case. Mm-hmm. But over time, I think they came, you know, to get used to me and to open up to me.
Now, you describe an investigation which it's kind of a classic morass. There's a bunch of different overlapping agencies. You've got the FBI, the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation, the sheriff's office, the local police all involved. Do you think in part because there are so many people, were so many people involved in this investigation, it has remained officially unsolved to date?
I think so. The problem was that she was a federal employee in a federal car, and her body was found in a U.S. forest, just been transferred to the national park system, mm-hmm. and so it had been a state park before that, and so it was unclear in the first weeks who had authority.
And it had been property which belonged to the sheriff. Is that correct?
Yes, another level of complication. The, mm-hmm. the property had been owned by the then sheriff. And so there's always a lot of milling around when there's a single jurisdiction in a murder case, particularly a messy murder case. But in this case, nobody knew who was in charge. There were even park rangers there, and no one knew who was in charge. And so I think they lost focus at least for the first few weeks and arguably for the first few months. I think they might have settled in earlier if there had been a single jurisdiction and that the investigators had been homicide specialists. The people who knew the most about homicide investigation were there, but because they one of them told me, because there was no clear line of authority, they had to be there in sort of an advisory capacity if asked. They couldn't basically take over the investigation. Mm-hmm. The scene where the body was discovered was just trampled. I mean, that sometimes happens even when there's a killing in a house in the suburbs, but it was a contaminated crime scene.
And what I think is kind of interesting here is that J. Edgar Hoover himself took a personal interest in the case. In one case, you write that he was writing liner notes to a Justice Department member criticizing the FBI's handling of the case. Was that unusual to have the director of the FBI so closely involved in what was a murder?
Right. It's unusual if it's not a high-profile case. But as it happened, the father of the victim had gone to law school with a man named Russell Long, who was then in the U.S. Senate, a powerful Democrat in the U.S. Senate. And he contacted Russell Long and said, "I don't think these guys know what they're doing. Can you help me?" And so Long then contacted J. Edgar Hoover, and Hoover was a very politically sensitive fellow. And once he knew that Russell Long was interested in this case, he jumped in, and the FBI, by that time, had withdrawn from the case. They were on the scene that day, but they'd withdrawn from the case, and Hoover sent them back in, and not only sent them back in, but made margin notes on their reports, and in a sense, directed part of the FBI's investigation, their involvement in the murder, before they finally bailed out.
Do you think it was easier for you to report on the case because you were based in Florida, the fact that there were these kind of links to Florida in this case?
In part, yes. When I made the decision to leave the Los Angeles Times in 1994 and was looking around for where I wanted to work next, I did want to come to the Southeast to be closer to North Carolina. At that point, I discovered that the fellow Vista who had been, in my view, unfairly accused of the murder and framed in a trial in 1985 and acquitted, it turned out he was in Central Florida. And so one of the factors in my decision to go to work for the Sentinel was the fact that he was here, although at that time he was still refusing to cooperate with me because he wanted to put this horrible experience behind him. But I mm-hmm. felt this would be a factor in my coming here. And as it turned out, after I came here and began working for the Sentinel, I was able to make contact with him and interview him extensively, probably not 20 minutes from the studio that we're sitting in.
Now, the story, I think, really starts to get interesting when the North Carolina authorities decide to indict Ed Walker for this crime. This is more than 10 years after the murder itself. Why did it take so long for this to happen?
Well, it was a very difficult case to solve because of the way of the initial investigation. And then in a small county, Madison County at that time and still today has around 17,000 people, big murder cases that don't get solved become political footballs. And there was a candidate who had been sheriff, and he wanted to become sheriff again. And he said that if he was elected, he would solve the Nancy Morgan murder case. And so in order to do that, actually, it was a re-election, not an election, a re-election, he had to come up with a plausible person to do it. And politically, it was much more acceptable that an outsider, that no one who lived in the county, who had friends and family in the county, who had a constituency in the county, he was the perfect, Ed Walker was the perfect person to charge because he had no following in the county. And it also played on the prejudice of the county, saying that we wouldn't do this horrible thing, but these outsiders did this horrible thing to one another. And so that's what I think motivated him toward the person that he charged, Ed Walker.
But as you write in the book, it didn't quite pan out that way because Ed Walker, in fact, had maintained links in the community and people did actually genuinely like him and supported him. So it didn't really work out that way for the prosecutors.
Right. There were so many people who still respected and liked him in the area of the county where he worked that at the trial, the judge said, I've heard enough character witnesses. The rest of you can go home. It's already been established about his character. And then the other thing was, although he had a horrible luck to be charged, he had great luck in just lucking into a country lawyer who was brilliant, and this became the case of his career, and he just did a magnificent job. As you say, the heart of the book is this courtroom drama that's just incredible. I just had to, in journalism, you say sometimes a story is so good, you just have to get out of the way of the story and let the story tell itself. And as people who read the book will see, in the center of the book, there is this courtroom drama that's just riveting.
Now, the third part of this book, you know, you detail, as you say, your approach to trying to bring this case to a conclusion. Are you pretty satisfied that you know, or you think you know, who killed Nancy Morgan and why?
I've told people I have about an 80% certainty, but I let the reader in the end decide between the two competing narratives. One, the local narrative, but I think most reasonable readers will probably come to my conclusion.
What happens now? Is there some part of you that hopes the State Bureau of Investigation will reopen their investigation or bring it to a conclusion along the lines you've suggested things played out?
It's kind of murky. The five people that I believe were involved, two of them are dead. One of them is serving a life sentence for murdering his five-year-old child. Another one is at large, but old and has had several strokes and, as you said, been shot several times in the head. So in recent years, there have been articles about my project, and inevitably, in the days following an article, I'll get a call from the State Bureau of Investigation. They'll say, well, let's have another look at this. Let's do this. And I say, fine. And then their interest trails off when there's no easy solution. There is DNA, but it's not conclusive at this point. It's very old DNA. It's 43 years old. And some of the people are not available, and a lot of the evidence has gone missing, and some of the fingerprints they've lost track of. So would I like them to accept my scenario? Yes.
And I guess a confession isn't enough at this point.
It hasn't been. For the one person who has confessed to me three times, once on tape and before witnesses, there's a reluctance to accept his confession because he is a compulsive liar, a psychotic, and a convicted murderer already.
I've been speaking to Mark Pinsky. He's a journalist and author. He was the Orlando Sentinel's religion reporter, and before that he spent many years covering the crime beat, amongst other newspapers, with the LA Times. His new book is called Meta on the Mountain, and it documents his 40-year-long quest to find out who killed a young federal anti-poverty worker, Nancy Morgan, in the hills of North Carolina. Mark, thank you very much for joining me.
It's great to be back, Matt.
Up next, a conversation with the University of Central Florida's head football coach, George O'Leary. Last month, the UCF Knights stunned college football fans by beating the number 8-ranked Louisville Cardinals. This weekend, they take on the Houston Cougars in a highly anticipated homecoming game. I spoke to UCF head coach George O'Leary. He explained why he thinks his team is doing so well this season.
I think right now, as far as, you know, we've stayed healthy for the most part, which I think is a big part of the game, you know, injury-wise. And I think basically we have a team that plays, feeds off each other from a chemistry standpoint. And that's really helped us as far as we're a very young team, and I think that's helped a lot of the young players.
Looking back to the Louisville game, which I guess people would say is sort of the defining moment of the season, were you sort of expecting to get that kind of a win?
I think, you know, if one game defined the tempo and the character of this team, it was that game from a, you know, never give up type attitude. And we were down 28-7 because of some mistakes we had made, but I thought the kids never gave up, and again, that's what it's about. We always talk about, you know, you practice and play the same way. They had an extremely good week in practice, and, you know, every time you cross that white line, it's game day. And I thought they went out there and they kept just doing what they need to be doing from an effort standpoint. And when you do that, usually good things happen, and football's a game of momentum, and that's what it turned out to be, a momentum game in the second half. I thought we dominated the line of scrimmage, and again, just kept pecking away and got that last score, which was a great play.
And when you talk about some of the missteps in the game, is it a measure of how good the team is that they can pick up and keep going and not get too rattled by those things?
Well, I think the poise of the football team in that game was outstanding. Obviously, it starts with your quarterback on offense. He kept his poise, and, you know, not everything went well the first couple of minutes of that game, but I thought we moved the ball down, and he made a mistake and threw a pick there, or else it would have been points there. But I thought he kept his poise, and I think there's a, you know, offensively there's a, he's never been a captain, and he won't because he's a quarterback. They are a captain, and they're the coach in the field, and he's done a great job. The players believe in what he does, and we have a lot of others that are helping that out, you know, as far as being productive, whether catching or running the ball or blocking. And I think it's just well chemistry team as far as offense concerned, led by a guy, Blake Bortles, who is productive and is like most good quarterbacks in today's day and age. He can take a bad play and make a good play out of it.
When you talked before about the fact that you're at this point now, not too many injuries, and that's kind of a good place to be, is that something you build into the strategy, or is that just partly a matter of luck?
Well, I don't know if it's luck. I think conditioning is a major, major point in this program. I think the weight coach deserves a lot of that credit from conditioning is concerned. And I think we have some depth. It's young. Right now, I think the Connecticut game, we had something like 23 either freshmen or redshirt freshmen in the game at some time. So, again, I think kids are getting an opportunity to play, which is great for morale. And we just continue rolling that way. But you know, I speed and luck go hand in hand. We have speed, and luck is following it right now.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's going to stay with you for the rest of the season?
I can't tell. I did that, I'd be in Vegas.
Now, after that game, the Knights ranked 23 in the BCS, and the game also had 2.2 million viewers at the time, and it was the highest-rated ESPN broadcast of the season. Is this putting a lot of pressure on the players, do you think?
No, I think it's great for the school. I think you could spend all the money that we spend on marketing, whether as a university or an athletic department, that you want. Nothing beats the national TV on ESPN. That goes throughout the whole country, and, you know, from California to Florida saw the game, and I think the reaction was pretty much the way it should be. It's a UCF. I don't think anybody has to ask what the initials stand for anymore. They know what they stand for, and that's our brand, UCF. And I think it was great for the players, great for everybody, and great for our fan base. I think the big thing we got to do now as a fan base is understand that we have a game, not who we're playing, and we have still too much of that going on. We have a great base as far as fans are concerned. There's still too many fringe people out there that are alumni or fans of the program that need to understand that, you know, attendance at the game is how they pay respect to the players. Mm-hmm. And because the players do respond to that.
The conference you're in now, is it tough enough for the team you've got? Would you think about maybe moving to a tougher conference like the ACC or the SEC if your team continues to have seasons like this?
Well, I don't know. I think that's an administrative decision as far as where we go, but I think there's no question the exposure we're getting from the American is better than anything we've had to date since I've been here. And as far as any time you can be on some form of ESPN, I think it does wonders for your program. More people get a chance to see you. And I think that's what it's all about. Is two things happen when you play on national TV. You either get great exposure or you get exposed, one or the other.
Now, it looks like you might have a primetime game when you host Houston as well. Are you worried that the spotlight might get to the players there? I mean, is that something you go into talking to them about?
Not really. What we do is, right after the middle of the season, I said we have 6 one-game championship games left. And we have only one goal. That's to win the conference championship each and every year. So they never lose sight of that goal. And they know that every game right now is, you know, very few football teams can really control their own destiny. We have an opportunity to do that by winning each and every game and getting what we want, a conference championship and the best bowl we can go to.
What about the war on I-4? Do you think this is the year that UCF finally gets to put that to rest?
I don't know. A lot of our fans make more of a bigger deal of that game. That's just a game for me, and we got a bunch of other conference games to play before then. But obviously, because of the locale and the distance, that becomes a very big game in the program. But it won't be a very big game in the program till the week we play them. We got a lot of other games that we have to take care of, and I don't get concerned about that game until we have to game plan and see what they're about, which right now is not in my eyes.
What about your players? Do they get hyped up by that kind of rivalry? Does it help them?
Well, I think the week we play, they get riled up because a lot of teammates are on the same teams and that type of thing. But I think they treat each game as they're supposed to treat it, as a season. And, you know, they won't get involved in that South Florida game until the week of the game. And I think that's the way it should be. That's the way we are in the program. They worry about, we got 3 or 4 other games before that one, and we got to do well in those games.
The Knights haven't historically had names on the backs of their jerseys. Is this the year that could change?
No, there's no names. We have one name on one jersey. It says team, and it hangs in their locker room. As I tell the players, if you're a good enough player, they know who the number is and who the kid is. And so if you're on the sideline, get on the field, they'll find out who your number is.
Now, this is your 10th season with UCF. Is this the best season you've had?
We've had good seasons. We've had a couple of 10-win seasons here now and one 11-win season. So, you know, we've had good teams and good players, but I don't even get involved in that until the end of the year and see where we stand as far as we've had better defenses. We've had better in some individual athletes. But overall, it's not the individuals that win games. It's the team. It's a we game, not a me game. And I think this team thoroughly understands the we part of that.
Just one final question, if I may. There's been quite a lot of talk in the NFL and a little bit in the college football as well about safety. What do you make of that whole debate?
I think the targeting rule has got out of whack. I think targeting, to me, is a very simple read as far as on the field where you're setting somebody up for contact. If it's within the play of the game and it's bang bang, it's hard to call that targeting. I think targeting to me is when you got someone sitting back waiting for a kid across field and he's just lining them up for a hit, not a bang bang play. And I think we got to get on the same page with some of the ones that have been called targeting throughout the country, and that's what actually we're wanting to get done with this, because obviously you got to protect the players.
That was George O'Leary, the head coach of the University of Central Florida's football team. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.